information is free.
The law? Of course.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
We care.
Here to border
it
on
shows.
The law?
Of course.
You will listen and obey.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether you went on with the diary, or whether he did not go up with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
And I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. Welcome, my friends, to episode 109 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, blasting out live, praradio.org, revereradio.net, your source for news, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups this week, stimulus bouts and secret accounts, Chicago gangsters, Davos banksters, biofuels, biometrics, cyborgs, killbots, and the Super Bowl, the 9/11 money and drill trail, MP3 players, and high fructose mercury syrup. It's all here. It's January 30th, 2009. It's episode 109 of MediaMonarchy.com.
Like a champion, but that's what.
Cursive. Rise Up, Rise Up. From their most recent record, Happy Hollow. If you've never listened to them, I highly recommend you check out Cursive's two albums, The Ugly Organ and Happy Hollow. Both paint amazing pictures of new millennial life, post-millennial tension. But welcome. Welcome back. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are, whenever you are. You're listening to the 109th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 30th, 2009. 130.09, episode 109. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster. Blasting out live, as always, Friday mornings at 10 Pacific Time, Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, 1 p.m. Eastern, simulcast live on the Revere Radio Network, the worldwide home of free speech, revereradio.net. And again, as always, thanks to the fine folks at KBFR, Boulder Free Radio in Colorado, 93.9, blasting out Media Monarchy. You can reach out and let your fingers do the talking. FaceSpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org are just most of the ways that you can get in touch with me and make a comment, make a contact, pose a question and a problem and a solution. It's getting heavy. It's getting heavy out there. And again, Obamanoids, have you had your old shit moment yet? We're, of course, going to kick it off with Chicago gangsters and corruption. Operation Board Games. And, of course, the connections to Rezco and Alchi and the foundations and Obama. And a bitter end for Blagojevich. Illinois governor has been impeached. 59-0, the Illinois senators voted to oust the devious and unfit governor. First from the Washington Post. The state senate... Try that again. From the Washington Post. The state senators stood up one by one in a hushed chamber on Thursday to call Governor Rod Blagojevich, Democrat, a liar and a hypocrite who put his ego in his pocketbook ahead of the interests of Illinois. One called him devious, cynical, crass, and corrupt. Another said the evidence of abuse of power was overwhelming. A third said he was, without a doubt, unfit to govern. Together, they voted 59-0 to reject Blagojevich's theatrical last-minute pleas and remove him from office, ending a stormy tenure that left the nation's fifth-largest state paralyzed by its governor's alleged misdeeds and nationally ridiculed for its latest bout of corruption. I believe our state must enter rehab, Senator Republican from Illinois Randall Holtgren told his colleagues before the vote. I believe our state must enter rehab. Moral rehab.
How can you throw a governor out of office on a criminal complaint and you haven't been able to show or prove any criminal activity? How can you throw a governor elected twice by the people out of office when the rules don't even require that you prove up elements of criminal allegations? And more than that, how can you throw a governor out of office who is clamoring and begging and pleading with you to give him a chance to bring witnesses in to prove his innocence, to do more than just ask for a presumption of innocence? Don't even give me that. Let me make my case. Let me bring my witnesses in. Let me show you that I'm innocent and I didn't do anything wrong. So Articles 1 to 8 do not show or prove any criminal case. And if that's the case, how can you throw me out of office without approving something like that and set a dangerous precedent that could have an impact on people and governors in Illinois and governors in other states? If you're impeaching me on providing safe and affordable prescription drugs, but going to Canada and getting the same medicines made by the exact same companies then the governor of Wisconsin ought to be impeached. The governor of Kansas ought to be impeached. The governor of Vermont ought to be impeached. And while we're at it, let's go reach right into the United States Senate and let's expel John McCain and Ted Kennedy, because I worked with them on this issue of the reimportation of prescription drugs. And then let's not stop there. Let's demand that President Obama fire Rahm Emanuel, because Rahm Emanuel was the one who gave me this idea. If you're going to throw me out of office for something like this, then how can those guys stay in the offices that they have?
Devious, a hypocrite, and a liar. Just three of the accusations levelled at Rod Blagojevich, the man who spent the past 6 years as one of the most powerful men in the state of Illinois, and who has now suffered a very public fall from grace. The Democrat has been the state governor for 2 terms. Now, though, he's been handed a lifetime ban from public office in Illinois. Blagojevich first ran into serious trouble 8 weeks ago when the state of Illinois was celebrating the election of its Senator Barack Obama, the highest office in the land, President of the United States. He was arrested on charges of trying to sell the Senate seat vacated by Obama. In the face of media storm, Blagojevich maintained time and again that he had done nothing wrong.
I want to apologize to you for what happened, but I can't, because I didn't do anything wrong. These are circumstances that have happened. And I'm sorry that we're all in.
I think it's better if you do it, okay? It's better if you do it just from a pressure point of view.
Yeah, good. I'll call him and say, yeah, we want to do an event downstairs.
But having listened to the FBI's recordings of Blagojevich talking to his brother, the state's lawmakers disagreed.
He failed the test of character. He is beneath the dignity of the state of Illinois. He is no longer worthy to be our governor, and I urge everybody here on behalf of the people I represent to vote to remove him from office.
59 senators voted unanimously to impeach him.
I now pronounce the judgment of conviction against Rod Blagojevich, thereby removing him from the office of governor, effective immediately.
Out with the old and in with the new. Within an hour of Blagojevich's impeachment, he was replaced by Lieutenant Governor Patrick Quinn.
Congratulations, Governor Quinn.
Thank you very much.
Blagojevich has vowed to clear his name. The fight is only just beginning. He'll also face a criminal trial. No date has been set for that yet.
I'm obviously saddened and disappointed, but not at all surprised by what the Senate did today. It was something that I knew they would do a long time ago, pursuant to a variety of different dynamics that have taken place since the world changed for us on December the 9th. At some point, I'd be happy to share some of those insights and thoughts with you. But I'm really here today just to say how grateful Patty and I and our daughters Amy and Annie are for the opportunity to be able to serve the people of Illinois, their governor, for the past 6 years. How blessed I personally feel to have had a chance to get up every day and try to fight for ordinary people, average people, people who otherwise don't have a voice. And I also want to say that I'm going to keep fighting to clear my name. I'm disappointed in the state Senate's actions, because they deprived me of an opportunity to bring witnesses and prove my innocence. I wanted to do that sooner rather than later. I guess I'll just have to wait until I have my day in court. But again, the people of Illinois, God bless all of you. Thank you for giving me a chance to represent you. I want you to know I haven't let you down. I've gotten up every day thinking about you, fighting for you, pushing and prodding for you, being frustrated on your behalf, frustrated at a phony kind of politics that burdens you with everything, frustrated with the phony kind of politics where politicians talk a big game but are not interested in getting anything done for you. We've done real things for you, real tangible, meaningful things that improved your lives. And I want you to know again how much I appreciate you and how much I love you. And I just want you to know, give me a chance so I can show you I haven't let you down.
A bitter end for Blagojevich, Illinois governor impeached. All those videos you can find in their entirety. So we heard the first and last word from Blago himself. Interestingly, the first part of that clip, Blagojevich called for Kennedy, McCain, and Emanuel to be fired. Said that if he was being impeached, then Senators Ted Kennedy, John McCain, and President Obama's chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, should also be fired. Now, perhaps it doesn't matter because he's already ruined, but I imagine Rahm, National Service, former Israeli Defense Force soldier Emanuel, probably isn't someone you fuck with. If you recall us going over him stabbing a table with knives, as he recited his enemies list, sending an opponent a dead fish, like a gangster. This guy, Rahm Emanuel, was the first appointment Obama made to his criminal cabinet. So, should you need to be versed in all this Chicago corruption, there are, of course, numerous links to ABC News and AP and opposingviews.com, as well as Senator Randall Holmgren's website, Mr. Moral Rehabilitation. More from Raw Story, more from Raw Replay. However, the two related appropriate flashbacks on MediaMonarchy.com. Jumping back to December 9th, Illinois governor arrested for trying to sell Obama's Senate seat. So maybe in Blagojevich's trial, he was going to try and maybe bring up Barry Sotero to the witness stand. The other flashback goes to July 2008. Illinois governor may send National Guard into Chicago to fight crime. So again, it's bickering between little rival gangster parties. However, they're all for the police state agenda. We're going to shift to the Econo crash, the ongoing Econo crash, and perhaps now would be the best time to mention themoneyfix.org. Documentary film by Portland, Oregon's own Alan Rosenblith, and again, themoneyfix.org, saw his, what I believe to be his final cut of his documentary. It's about to go play at the Big Sky Film Festival in, I believe, Montana in a few weeks. Saw it here in Portland last night at the Hollywood Theater, Shades of Grey Media, and Alan Rosenblith, and he was there, introduced the film, did a Q&A afterwards. So I'm holding a postcard. The Money Fix is a feature-length documentary exploring our society's relationship with money. While most of us take the monetary system for granted, it has silent and profound implications for everyone. Have you ever wondered what money is or where it comes from? The truth is that all money enters the economy as bank debt. So what, you may ask? This seemingly innocuous detail is actually at the core of many of the social and environmental problems of today. The Money Fix examines economic patterning in both the human and the natural worlds, and through this lens we learn how we can empower ourselves by redesigning the lifeblood of the economy at the community level. The film documents three types of alternative money systems, all of which help solve economic problems for the communities in which they operate. This film will utterly transform the way you perceive money and economics. And it has exclusive interviews with, among others, Noam Chomsky and William Grider. If you're someone that has seen The Money Masters or America from Freedom to Fascism, this film doesn't shed a whole lot of light on the secretive nature of money creation and the Federal Reserve, but it does fortunately point out, and it has the phrase that pays, the slogan that works, the Federal Reserve is like Federal Express. It's not federal, and there are no reserves. It has that line in there. You can hear it in Money Masters. You can hear it in American Freedom to Fascism. You can hear Dennis Kucinich saying it on the floor of the House just a few weeks ago. So I stuck around for the Q&A and heard lots of well-meaning folks and references to, oh, after the last 8 years of blah, blah, blah. I didn't put my 2 cents in, although I was kind of biting my tongue. I should have spoken up, I suppose, and said, hey, Obama's a Wall Street frontman. Who did he put in at the Treasury? Timothy Geithner, Federal Reserve guy. I talked to the director of themoneyfix.org, Alan Rosenblith, for just a second after the film, shook his hand, congratulated on him, and said, hey, weren't you on Alex Ansari's Outside the Box? He said, whoa, yeah, I was. That was a wild ride, or that was wild, or that was kind of crazy. Which kind of, to me, signaled, oh, that's crazy conspiracy theory. That's the interesting part when you get into these investigations is how far it goes and how hardcore it is. Sometimes doesn't connect dots. It can explain things, but doesn't put the pieces together. Limited hangout sometimes. However, I totally support it. Local filmmaker, wish him the best. TheMoneyFix.org, and I'm sure as the DVD comes out, he'll probably put up a low-res version of it, so you can share it, much like you can and should share The Money Masters. So, now I've set the table for the Econo Crash, Davos, Panic, Pyramid Schemes, and Market Magic. First, from MarketWatch, and I believe this was picked up in many other locations as well. Do we need a North American currency? Thomas Jefferson once said, "When you reach the end of your rope, tie a knot in it and hang on." As the global financial system pushes on a string, investors are desperately trying to hold tight. The New World Order is upon us, full of hope, promise, and a fair amount of fear. In our recent discussion regarding the direction of our country, we noted the risks of catering to conventional wisdom and the implications for the U.S. dollar. See previous Market Watch columns. So again, just to clarify this for you, mainstream economic press, once again, New World Order is upon us, full of hope, promise, and a fair amount of fear. Years ago, the Federal Reserve wrote a solution paper regarding the need to combat zero-bound interest rates. The concern was the flight of capital from the U.S., and an option discussed was a two-tiered currency, one for U.S. citizens and one for foreigners. Canadian economist Herbert Grubel first introduced a potential manifestation of this concept in 1999, the North American currency, called the Amero, A-M-E-R-O. Called the Amero in select circles, this North American currency would effectively commingle the Canadian dollar, U.S. dollar, and Mexican peso. On its face, while difficult to imagine, it makes intuitive sense. The ability to combine Canadian natural resources, American ingenuity, and cheap Mexican labor would allow North America to compete better on a global stage. Experience has taught us, however, that perceived solutions introduced by policymakers and politicians don't always have the desired effect. Because anymore, people are catching on. At least I hope they are. God, it, and again, seems all so apparent. Once you get a couple good keys, you can start unlocking the rest of the doors for yourself. And again, putting the puzzle together. It's going to be a theme. But I spend a lot of time studying and reading and researching this stuff. So it seems somewhat on its face, oh, it's all connected. I see it. I see the matrix, if you will. But I've studied it a lot. So it's hard to not get frustrated with other folks who don't get it at all. Or, hell, none of us gets it. I don't get it. The smartest thing you can say is, I don't know shit. I have a lot to learn. So let's keep learning. Let's move to businessandmedia.org, Business and Media Center. White House will create crisis and panic to push stimulus. As this is snaking its way around. Is the new Obama administration taking cues from the Bush administration to get Congress to act? It certainly seemed that way to South Carolina's junior Republican Senator Jim DeMint. DeMint, speaking on the 27th at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C., explained the Obama administration will, quote, create crisis and widespread panic just like its predecessor in order to get Congress to act expeditiously. Another senator, James Inhofe, Republican from Oklahoma, explained the Bush administration used similar tactics of fear under the direction of former Treasury Secretary Goldman Sachs Henry Paulson to get the $700 billion TARP bailout bill passed by Congress back on October 4th, 2008. If you recall, there were other folks from Congress saying they had threatened not only congressional martial law, a sort of Robert's Rules phrase, but they also referenced riots in the streets and martial law on the streets in America. Jim DeMint says that this new Obama change administration is still going to create crisis and panic to push what is right now just a stimulus bill.
Now, I think there's a lot of buyer's remorse among Republicans who voted for the bailouts of all kinds last year. And it's hard to prove that some of them are saying, well, it didn't work out so well, but it would have been a lot worse if we had. It's hard to argue that unless you know anything about how business works. And then it's obvious that what we did is inject a whole lot of uncertainty into the marketplace. So, no, I don't think there's discord because of that. And I really don't blame my colleagues. If you've got the President and the Secretary of Treasury coming in saying the world economy is going to collapse next week if we don't do something, I've been around long enough to know whenever someone tells me I have to make a decision right now, my response is no. That clears it up right away. And I think more and more, Bush administration and now this administration knows that they're not going to get quick reaction out of Congress unless they create a crisis and widespread panic. And that's going to be their MO to get Congress back. Well, it's a good question, and a lot of us are saying that. It's not being picked up at all by mainstream media. And again, we're going to have to take our message through you to the people, Rush Limbaugh, one who will talk about what's really in the bill. We don't need to make it up. It's like they're in a different reality. They're talking about a bill. When you look at it, there's no resemblance to what they're talking about. And so if we can just get the truth to the American people, or just a segment of the American people, I think you'll see a groundswell of anger again. Because there's a real fatigue out there on the bailouts. I think even people who normally are not that political are coming up to me, and they just say that we're running this country into a ditch. I've never seen people so anxious. They grab my arm. They're no longer single issue people. They just say, thanks for fighting. What can I do? I've heard that at least 100 times. We just need to let people know the truth, and I think they'll get engaged.
The last thing he said there is we need to get people the truth, and I think they'll get engaged. So whether that's just left-right phony, left-right paradigm pandering from the Republican side of the aisle at the Heritage Foundation, he's right, though. They'll all create crisis and panic to pass things, whether it's 9/11, or the bailout, the financial 9/11. They create the crisis to get the reaction so they can offer the solution. There's another one about Jim DeMint. More on this topic from thinkprogress.org. DeMint predicts zero Senate GOP votes for Obama stimulus, and we'll check out some of the updates on that when we get through this wretched econo crash posting, Davos panic, pyramid schemes, and market magic. We'll do the pyramids before we move to the Shakespearean market magic. New York CEO arrested over latest Ponzi pyramid scheme. This from the AFP. A New York CEO was arraigned Tuesday on charges of fleecing investors through a pyramid or Ponzi scheme. A spokeswoman for the FBI says that Nicholas Cosmo, chief executive of Agape World Incorporated, was due in court following his arrest late Monday. Cosmo, quote, planned and carried out a fraudulent scheme targeting some 1,500 investors and a total of $370 million.
Congress is demanding answers from federal regulators about the Bernard Madoff scandal as more and more alleged schemes are being uncovered every day.
Angry senators grilled regulators, including the enforcement chief of the Securities and Exchange Commission, over the failure to uncover Bernard Madoff's alleged $50 billion investment fraud scheme.
Word was out on this guy. How did the SEC avoid not reacting to this?
What they are reacting to is an alarming number of so-called mini Madoffs popping up all over the country. In Tampa, Florida, hedge fund manager Arthur Nadel surrendered to authorities after 2 weeks on the run. Authorities say he overstated the value of investments in six funds by roughly $300 million. In Long Island, New York, Nicholas Cosmo is charged with cheating some 1,500 investors out of tens of millions of dollars.
I'm very worried that it's going to pay out.
How much do you have?
$250,000.
In both cases, prosecutors say thousands of new investors lost millions of dollars.
We're joined by Mark Restivo, who says that he lost $200,000 in the Nicholas Cosmo alleged scam. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
$200,000, your life savings?
Pretty much.
Everything?
I was going to pay my house off.
You had plans for this money, so when you heard about the Bernard Madoff scandal, you immediately called to make sure that your money was okay, right?
Well, I went to a Copy World in Hop Hog on Monday, asking just for answers. And when the brokers just passed us, I was left hanging for them. Just left me hanging. It's a horrible feeling.
What did they say?
Nothing. Just walked right by me.
When did you know that you had lost all your money?
That day. That day. That was when my American dream and many other investors, and I'm here today to speak on all those investors that can't be here today. And I could tell them that we're going to fight. We must stand together and file. Do what we need to do with the government, the FBI, whoever else is involved in this.
New York CEO arrested over pyramid scheme, and of course the thing that ties in with that and what that video is related to is that, of course, mini Madoffs popping up all over the place. As the banksters get desperate, they're making more desperate and obvious flailing moves. That should scare the rest of us. Greedy money bastards though they may be, they are looking at things on the supply end from the top down. If they're getting nervous at the top that shit's about to fall apart, even for them, even for the supposed moneyed, they're going to get burned too. They're getting burned right now. It's going to trickle down to us. So something like the money fix goes over is how you need to set up something in your community. Links in there to the Washington Post, so more on the mini Madoffs, but also stuff from Reuters out of the UK and AFP. We're now to the Shakespearean market magic. Baboon's Blood offers Davos leaders Shakespearean market magic. That is the title of an article from Bloomberg News. And for a second, you could say, well, at least it's kind of interesting. You know, they're getting the arts kind of involved in Shakespearean and theater. But this has such bizarre occult overtones and the whole alchemy of money. Baboon's Blood offers Davos leaders Shakespearean market magic. That old black magic has even the World Economic Forum in its spell. Double, double, toil and trouble, fire, burn, and cauldron bubble, says World Economic Forum delegate Richard Olivier, one of the 2,500 global business and political leaders starring at the forum's 39th annual meeting this week in Davos, Switzerland. The son of Shakespearean actor Laurence Olivier isn't conjuring up Wall Street's triple witching hour before its next scheduled appearance in March. He's hosting a seminar titled Leadership Lessons from Macbeth. Four Davos delegates, who include Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, more on him in a moment, News Corp CEO Rupert Murdoch, and Chinese Premier Wen Jiabao. Cool it with a baboon's blood, the 47-year-old Olivier advises, reciting the witch's recommendation to the troubled Thane of Calder in Shakespeare's play. The Davos theme this season is shaping the post-crisis world. Yet, Olivier reckons the kettle of fiscal crises, currently heating up Davos delegates from J.P. Morgan and Chase CEO Jamie Dimon to AIG Vice Chairman Jacob Frenkel. That, of course, makes the Davosian stage an ideal venue for the princes of Wall Street to delve into the magic of Macbeth and discuss how they persuaded people, including themselves, to believe in things that were not real. When magic involves money, some call it economics, a sometimes illusory undertaking that 2008 showed to be big on vanishing acts. U.S. mutual funds declined by $2.4 trillion, according to Investment Company Institute, losing a fifth of their value from a year earlier. Last year, the value of global stock markets shrank by almost half to around $30 trillion. A recent study by Morgan Stanley foretells of hedge fund assets valued at some $1.8 trillion in early 2008, dematerializing into $900 billion by the end of this year. As for the prestidigitators of profit, more than 200,000 of them dissolved into thin air in 2008, including 52,000 layoffs at Citigroup. Foremost among the sleight-of-hand experts is Bernard Madoff, shaman-in-chief of a New York-based investment securities firm. Federal prosecutors have charged with running a Ponzi scheme, charming clients out of some $50 billion. The dark, black magic of Macbeth has a particular resonance this year at Davos, says Olivier, artistic director of Olivier Mythodrama in London, a corporate leadership training outfit that has coached executives at Nokia and Royal Dutch Shell. It's about ambition, about how people who have bloody, murderous, or greedy thoughts attract bloody, murderous, or greedy spirits. This article goes on, but I think you get the idea. Baboon's Blood offers Davos leaders Shakespearean market magic. Links in there for you to the International Herald Tribune, bizcommunity.com, more from Wikipedia, and of course, worldeconomicforum.org. We see a lot, again, coming from mainstream sources where they're talking about magic and alchemy and the occult and the New World Order. A lot from the International Herald Tribune, like this one. UN crime chief says drug money keeps banks afloat. The United Nations Crime and Drug Watchdog has indications that money made in illicit drug trade has been used to keep banks afloat in the global financial crisis, its head was quoted as saying last Sunday. Vienna-based UNODC Executive Director Antonio Maria Costa said in an interview released by Austrian weekly Profil, and there's a link to a bad Google translation, but it's there for you. Drug money often became the only available capital when the crisis spiraled out of control last year. In many instances, drug money is currently the only liquid investment capital. Costa was quoted as saying by Profil, and that's P-R-O-F-I-L, Austrian magazine. In the second half of 2008, liquidity was the banking system's main problem, and hence liquid capital became an important factor. The United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime had found evidence that, quote, interbank loans were funded by money that originated from drug trade and other illegal activities. There were signs that some banks were rescued in that way. Profil said Costa declined to identify countries or banks which may have received drug money and gave no indication how much cash might be involved. He only said Austria was not on the top of his list, Profil said the Austrian magazine. Drug money keeps banks afloat. Again, if you study this, that's not a big surprise. It is a big surprise when they blast it out on the International Herald Tribune. It's always been about drugs. Drugs, oil, guns, and gold. But of course, we all need a little stimulus. As the stimulus bill sends thrills through the Washington, D.C. region and also all around the world as everybody lines up for a little bit of economic New World Order stimulus.
Barack Obama was still lobbying for his economic rescue plan even as the House started final debate. The president met with worried business executives, then declared America's growing army of jobless needs prompt action.
And all those who live in fear that their job will be next on the cutting blocks, they need help now.
There's incredible fear. Everybody's just so concerned about what's going to happen next that things are just locking up.
Obama hoped his personal appeal to Republicans for backing would translate into GOP votes. But debate on the $819 billion package of spending and tax cuts made clear he was hoping in vain.
The Democrat plan fails to provide a swift and substantial positive impact on the economy.
We cannot borrow and spend our way back to prosperity.
Democrats maintain that tax breaks coupled with spending on roads and bridges, energy and health care are just the tonic for an economy in crisis.
This bill provides urgently needed relief for struggling individuals and businesses and will create or retain 3 to 4 million jobs in this country.
And in the end, it was only Democrats who voted for the plan.
The yeas are 244, the nays are 188.
Not a single Republican went along. Despite the missing bipartisanship, Obama praised the House action as a step forward.
The president's focus now shifts to the Senate, where different rules and a more collegial atmosphere could yield more bipartisanship, but at a price. Senators are working on bigger tax cuts and more spending that could make this already massive package even more costly. Mark Smith, The Associated Press, The White House.
So that's from the Associated Press. What goes along with that? The stimulus bill sends thrill through the region, Washington Post. However, if we glance quickly to Google News, Canadian stocks edged lower after grim GDP data. That GDP data meaning U.S. gross domestic product shrank almost 4% last quarter. That would be the most since 1982. Comics take final swipes at Blagojevich and second ballot needed to decide next RNC chairman. But if we return to MediaMonarchy.com, banks and standing armies. The quote, and I sincerely believe with you that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, comes to us from, of course, Thomas Jefferson. In another example of the amazing way some of our TV talking heads that we love to hate to love, that sometimes, wow, they're getting information out there, and other times they cover it up. Glenn Beck likes to play that he knows what's up with the New World Order.
You know, I'm just like you, man. I watch the news and I see it. I'm like, wait a minute, that's not a separate story. These stories are all connected. The media never puts them together like a puzzle, but that's really what the news is. Let's put some together. First, the housing market collapses because banks are forced to make loans with people who can't pay them back. Next, the bailout bonanza. We just keep on giving money with no results. Next, where's that money coming from? Oh, yeah, we're printing it in the basement and devaluing our currency. And finally, we're starting to nationalize our banks. This is pretty good. Bank of America will literally become Bank of America, which is great because we can save money. We don't really have to spend money on new signs. This all forms a big puzzle. Here it is. The government is to blame for each and every one of these pieces. President Obama, is he Bush on steroids? And how long is this going to last before somebody says, okay, this isn't making any sense to me anymore. Republican Congressman and former presidential candidate Ron Paul is joining us now. Hello, Congressman. How are you?
Good. Nice to be with you.
You know, the more I read of the Founding Fathers and the more I read your words, they're almost interchangeable. Let me start with the words of Thomas Jefferson. Here it is. I sincerely believe that banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies, and the principle of spending money to be paid by posterity under the name of funding is but swindling futurity on a large scale. Wanted to get you on because I don't know if futurity is a real word. Any idea? No.
Okay.
Anyway, Thomas Jefferson is basically saying the banks stealing from our children and funding us is a really bad thing, and the banks are a really bad thing when we get into bed with them. And that's exactly what we're doing. You've been crying out in the wilderness for a long time, and people haven't really been listening to you. And you know what, Congressman? I don't know if they're listening to you yet. What's it going to take?
Well, I think it's going to take a collapse of the dollar because there's no intent here in Washington to change its ways. We're spending more, borrowing more, and printing more, and that's why we're in the trouble that we're in. So since we're not going to do that, all the burden is placed on the value of the dollar. You can't create trillions and trillions of dollars and think we can bail out all the bad investments. And yet that's all we seem to be doing here. And it's sort of contagious. You know, we have appropriated money to bail out so many big companies and big banks already. It is the excuse for coming back, and nobody can be not denied. Now you can say, well, so-and-so needs money, and there'll be, and they're logical. They say, well, if you bail out the big banks and AIG and all these companies, why not bail out the little guy? So the bailout is a disease. It's contagious. It's ongoing. And the result of this will be the destruction of the dollar, which to me means runaway inflation and political chaos. Okay. Very, very dangerous.
Hang on, because you're saying runaway inflation. You're meaning Weimar Republic, wheelbarrow full of money kind of stuff to buy a loaf of bread. Is that the kind of inflation you're talking about?
I think it will end before it gets that far along. They'll come to their senses, but it's going to be bad. But everybody's lulled to sleep and say, well, there's no inflation. But if you measure inflation by the increase in supply of money, I mean, we're doing it. So the inflation is already here.
Well,
the effects have yet to be known.
Right. I talked to Stephen Moore at the Wall Street Journal, and he talked to the Treasury. It looks like we have increased the money supply by 70% since October. They're running these presses 24 hours a day. The effects of this, you're saying, will destroy the currency. So then what happens? What do we replace it with? Or what? I mean, that sounds crazy,
well,
Congressman.
Yeah, but you'll have to start over again with a new system. And the history shows you, you have to go back to a sound currency that the people will believe in and have trust in. Right now, the trust in the system, which was the Bretton Woods financial system, that trust is gone. That's why it has seized up and it doesn't work.
Okay.
The dollar is still accepted, and they're relying on the trust in the dollar, but I believe that'll come to an end.
You know, Congressman, there's one group of stories that I don't see covered in the media at all, and we're looking into it, and that is all of these countries are allies. We have France, we have England, we have Germany. They just met 2 weeks ago over in France, where they talked about a new sort of capitalism where government has the role at the table. Also, they're all talking about some sort of a new currency, that there needs to be a new gold standard, which, unfortunately for us, the dollar is the world's gold standard. I don't see any coverage of this anywhere, and it seems to me that that would be kind of an important story for the American people to know about. Can you give me any update on this? Are you following this story?
Well, no, they deny that information to us. Matter of fact, the other day when Bernanke was supposed to be before the banking committee, I complained about it that he didn't show up, but he was in Basel, Switzerland, meeting with all the other central bankers, talking exactly about what you're talking about. But under the law, they're not required to tell us anything. And that is why I'm working so hard to try to get transparency of the Federal Reserve.
Okay.
The responsibility falls on Congress.
Real quick, just two quick questions. Hillary Clinton, as the Secretary of Treasury, any comment on that? Our Secretary of State. Yeah,
I think policy is going to remain the same. I think foreign policy is dictated by individuals who control both the Republican and the Democrat Party. So don't expect any significant change in foreign
and,
policy.
And the Secretary of Treasury, Geithner, should he be the guy or not?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, we just gave him $350 billion, and he doesn't know what he did with it exactly.
Is he going to be?
It was mismanagement. So we're going to give him another $350. I suspect that he will be approved.
Okay, thank you very much. Congressman, we'll talk to you again.
Of course, all the gangsters are approved. Geithner and Clinton, all of it. Criminal cabinet. Change the face, the agenda moves on. Banking establishments are more dangerous than standing armies. There's another article from Ron Paul on strengthening or weakening the economy, and even again to reference the documentary I saw last night, The Money Fix. Even the director of it said, oh, I'm a big Obama supporter, but what he's doing is basically going to bankrupt the country. You hear kind of the air let out of the room. What? This Goldman Sachs Federal Reserve? Brzezinski? Soros? Frontman? It's not gonna... You want to know what the Navy's idea of stimulus is? Torpedoes, missiles, and jets. This, of course, from Danger Room. The Navy's hoping the stimulus bill will pay for more missiles, more fighter jets, more torpedoes. The gazillion-dollar economic aid package making its way through Congress puts a premium on projects that can generate jobs ASAP. So the Pentagon has given some suggestions in terms of military hospitals, clinics, barracks, and some child care centers and things like that where we think the work could begin right away or is already underway that could be accelerated. Defense Secretary Robert Designated Successor Gates told senators the other day, but in an internal Navy memo obtained by InsideDefense.com, the memo goes farther than these mom-and-pop apple pie construction projects. Instead, the Navy suggests, how about some, quote, Tomahawk cruise missiles, MK-48 torpedoes, or SM-2 air defense missiles, warfighting equipment such as small boats, riverine, and coastal warfare craft, and on and on and on. Which sounds a lot more like the Navy's typical shopping list than an attempt to get Americans working in a hurry. Not surprising, but lame. Meanwhile, taxpayers for common sense finds an extra billion in the stimulus bill for nuclear stockpile watchers at the Department of Energy's National Nuclear Security Administration. Plus, there's another 200 mil for the oft-troubled effort to build a high-tech fence along the Mexican border. New Homeland Stupidity Secretary Janet Napolitano, at her nomination hearing this month, criticized the fence, which of course has already doubled in cost since construction began. That's their complaints about it. That's always the complaints about things. I don't really object to these Nazi police state tactics. It just doesn't have to be so expensive. Considering the controversy around increased spending on the weapons complex and border fence, these passages of the legislation should raise some fucking flags over its shovel readiness. So here is Danger Room's question to y'all. Should defense projects even be considered part of the stimulus package? Obviously, some of them do generate jobs, but with the Pentagon already gobbling up more than $600 billion a year, hasn't the military-industrial complex had more than its fill? And that's an amazingly forthright piece from Danger Room, and of course, we'll hear from them again in just a little bit. Returning again to the International Herald Tribune. Again, newspaper to the elites. More Americans joining military as jobs dwindle. As the number of jobs across the nation dwindles, more Americans are joining the military, lured by a steady paycheck, benefits, and training. The last fiscal year was a banner one for the military, with all active duty and reserve forces meeting or exceeding their recruitment goals for the first time since 2004, the year that violence in Iraq intensified drastically, Pentagon officials said. And the trend seems to be accelerating. The Army exceeded its targets each month for October, November, December, the first quarter of the new fiscal year, bringing in a total of 21,443 new meats to be shoved into the grinder in active duty and in the reserves. December figures were released last week, jumping down in the article, quote, when the economy slackens and unemployment rises and jobs become more scarce in civilian society, recruiting is less challenging, said Curtis Gilroy, the director of accession policy for the Department of Defense. Accession. Accession. We'll access you and we will acquisition you. Still, the economy alone does not account for the military's success in attracting more recruits. The recent decline in violence in Iraq has also had a positive effect, Gilroy said. Again, the fake economy collapses. The only jobs will be with the Stasi military-industrial complex. Speaking of secret agents, this from Time magazine, from Soviet agent to London newspaper proprietor. What can you get for a single unit of Britain's poor, battered currency? Not much. Apart from power, influence, and an entree into the highest echelons of the British establishment, these are the potential byproducts of an agreement reached on January 21st by Russian oligarch and politician Alexander Lebedev, L-E-B-E-D-E-V. He's buying the London's largest newspaper, the Evening Standard, from its current owners, Associated Newspapers, for the nominal fee of £1. The bargain basement price is arguably the least startling aspect of a transaction that, if confirmed next month following a staff consultation process and barring intervention by the UK government, will open a new and bizarre chapter in Anglo-Russian relations. Lebedev, after all, is a former KGB operative who spied on Britain under diplomatic cover during the Cold War. By his own account, scouring news sources such as the Evening Standard for tidbits to feed to his handlers back home. His exotic pedigree has caused a few splutters. Richard Otway, a conservative MP, said he felt, quote, the fact that Lebedev has been a member of the Foreign Security Service meant there should be an inquiry into the sale. I think it's one more example that we're no more serious nation that we allow a serious paper to be taken over in our capital by a Russian oligarch, harumphed Sir Peregrine Wursthorn, an octogenarian former newspaper editor. Soviet agent, newspaper proprietor. From the military to the media. From Wikinews, Irish millionaire found dead of suspected suicide. If we're keeping score, I believe that's the third suicide we've noted, at least, of millionaires in this new economic world order. Irish property businessman Patrick Rocca, R-O-C-C-A, Rocca, has been found dead in his home. Police reports indicate that suicide is the probable cause. He was 42. Rocca was discovered dead with one shot to the head. The Irish Times has confirmed that there appears to be no suspicious circumstances surrounding this shot and that the firearm involved has been confiscated. Rocca was believed to have assets worth of 500 euro millions. He had worked in business for around 25 years since he joined his family business, Rocca Tiles. Irish millionaire dead of suspected suicide. And again, we note, first, we take no joy in the pain or death or suffering of anyone else. But we note the sign seen in Wall Street during the initial protests. Jump, you fuckers. Over 8 in 10 corporations have secret tax havens. This from the Associated Press. 83 of the nation's 100 largest corporations, including Citigroup, Bank of America, and News Corp, has subsidiaries in offshore tax havens. And some of the companies received federal bailout funding. The GAO, Government Accountability Office, released a report that said Bank of America, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, and more all had more than 100 units in countries that maintain low or no taxes. The three financial institutions were included in the $700 billion financial bailout approved by a buffaloed Congress. Again, a lot of these things, if you swim in these waters and study these things, it's not a surprise. You know that drugs and money keep the banks rolling. Drug money keeps the banks rolling, and they all have offshore things, and they don't pay fucking taxes at all. Just like our new Treasury Secretary, Timothy Geithner, from the Federal Reserve. But again, to see it in the Associated Press, see it in the International Herald Tribune, it's all spilling out. An update on old Pooty Poot at the Davos World Economic Forum. This update from the Telegraph. Putin calls for end of dollar stranglehold. Russian Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has called for concerted action to break the stranglehold of the U.S. dollar and create a new global structure of regional powers. Quote, the one reserve currency has become a danger to the world economy. That is now obvious to everybody. It's the first time a Russian leader's ever set foot in the sanctum sanctorum, holy of holies, holiest of holies, rather, of global capitalism at Davos. Putin said the leading power should ensure an irreversible move towards a system of multiple reserve currencies, questioning the reliability of the U.S. dollar as a safe store of value. The pride of Wall Street investment banks don't exist anymore. And finally, on this Econo Crash posting, Davos panic, pyramid schemes, and market magic. South African diplomat says Jewish money controls the U.S. This from the AFP, of course, whipping up a shitstorm. South Africa's deputy foreign minister has been taken before the National Human Rights Body for allegedly saying that Jewish money controls the United States. Fatima Hajag, F-A-T-I-M-A, H-A-J-A-I-G. Fatima Hajjag allegedly told a political rally 2 weeks ago in Johannesburg that Jews control America no matter which government comes into power, whether Republican or Democrat, whether Obama or Bush. Their control of America, just like the control of most Western countries, is in the hands of Jewish money. Outraged by the remarks, the South African Jewish Board of Deputies, a civil rights group, said it filed a complaint Wednesday against Hajjag at the Human Rights Commission. Links in there and updates from news24.com and jewishsa.co.za. And, of course, more on Jewish money. And Fatima Hajjag even has a Wikipedia entry. Does Jewish money control the U.S.? Of course it does. Does British money control the U.S.? Does Vatican money control the U.S.? Do international banksters control all the other countries? Of course they do. She just said the bad stuff.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Looking abroad, looking at geopolitics, looking at Iceland, Iraq, Iran, and black ops. First from CNN, Iceland's government collapses. Iceland's ruling coalition resigned this last Monday, 3 months after the collapse of the country's currency, stock market, and several major banks, and following months of public protests. See, again, we've seemingly changed topics and changed posts, but it's all the same story. Collapse of the country's currency, stock market, several major banks, months of public protests. Christian Christensen, a spokesman for the prime minister, said the government also fell after the resignation of the government's commerce minister in response to the country's financial mess. The minister, Bjorgvin Sigurdsson, resigned Sunday, saying the government had failed to restore confidence in the 3 months after the collapse of the financial system. And again, we've been watching Iceland, we've been watching Greece, we've been watching the unrest as fake economies collapse and pissed off people take to the streets. From the Associated Press, Iraq to reopen notorious Abu Ghraib prison. Iraq will reopen the notorious Abu Ghraib prison next month, but it's getting a facelift and a new name. The heavily fortified compound of gray stone-walled buildings and watchtowers has come to symbolize American abuse of some prisoners captured in Iraq after photos were released showing U.S. soldiers sexually humiliating inmates at the facility. The scandal stoked support for the insurgency and was one of the biggest setbacks to the U.S. military effort to win the peace in Iraq. The renovated facility will be called Baghdad Central Prison, because the name Abu Ghraib has left a bitter feeling inside Iraqis' hearts, said Deputy Justice Minister Busho Ibrahim. Abu Ghraib, which was a torture center under Saddam Hussein, has been closed since 2006. Links and more in there for you to Press TV and Voice of America News. Now to Iran and the covert ops. This from the Jerusalem Post. U.S. seizing of Iranian ship, a covert op. The interception of an Iranian arms ship by the U.S. Navy in the Red Sea last week was likely conducted as a covert operation and is being downplayed by the U.S. military due to the lack of clear legal framework for such operations, an American expert on Iran told the Jerusalem Post on last Saturday evening. International media reported that an Iranian-owned merchant vessel flying a Cypriot flag was boarded early last week by U.S. Navy personnel who discovered artillery shells on board. So, again, it's interesting to see internationally who's talking about what and who's calling out who and who's pointing the fingers. So we got that report, U.S. seizing of Iranian ship, a covert op, from the Jerusalem Post. Coming back here to WorldNet Daily, U.S. Navy intercepts Iranian arms vessel. The U.S. Navy is conducting covert operations aimed at intercepting Iranian ships carrying weapons to rearm Hamas in the Gaza Strip, setting the stage for some provocation. Of course, last year it was that clumsy speedboat event could have been a fake Gulf of Tonkin. And then not long after that, we discovered again, of course, from Seymour Hersh that, you know, Cheney wanted to dress up Navy guys like Iranians and shoot at them. False flag terror. Their favorite trick. I now see, my friends, that we are into our number two of this 109th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's January 30th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you live every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Time from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, thanks to the worldwide home of free speech, RevereRadioNetwork.com. And again, thanks to KBFR 93.9 in Boulder for rebroadcasting the show. And, of course, all the portals to reach out and touch someone. Continuing. This will kind of break things up a little bit. This one will be a little funnier. And, again, always trying to put the media back into the monarchy. This from Danger Room and a numerous wealth amount of other places. Because, again, it's silly, it's corrupt, and it's kind of funny and sad. Sensitive Army files found on used MP3 player. It's like burn after reading. Kinda, sorta. A New Zealand man has found confidential United States military files on an MP3 player. He bought it at an Oklahoma thrift shop for less than $10. Chris Ogle, O-G-L-E, from New Zealand, wasn't looking for secrets during his little shopping trip, of course, but when he brought the player home and hooked it up, he discovered a playlist he could never have imagined. The 60 files included personal details of American soldiers, equipment data, and what appears to be a mission briefing. Most of the info comes from 2005, however, and there are no report of truly secret squirrel material, so it may not be enough to get Brad Pitt or Francis McDormand of the Coen brothers involved in a Down Under remake, alas. However, more on MP3 confidential, sensitive Army files found on used MP3 player.
American military secrets discovered on an MP3 player and sold at a bargain basement price. That confidential information isn't even in the United States anymore. Our John Zarella has got the mystery for us.
John and Kieran, this is a story that will have many people, especially American soldiers, asking how in the world did that happen? A New Zealand man buys a used MP3 player in Oklahoma and discovers that the little device is holding confidential U.S. military files.
Chris Ogle says he bought this MP3 player a year ago at a thrift store in Oklahoma City, but it wasn't until a few weeks ago, back home in New Zealand, that he tried downloading a song from it, and that's when about 60 military files, some he says labeled top secret, popped up on the screen.
The more I look at it, the more I see, and I guess I think I should be.
Ogle said the files included home addresses, social security, and cell phone numbers of U.S. soldiers. It also included what appeared to be mission briefings and lists of equipment deployed to hotspots. All the information dating back to 2005. The New Zealand journalist who first reported the story verified the authenticity of the files by calling one of the soldiers listed.
Hello, is this Chuck?
Yeah, speaking.
The reporter says once she explained why she was calling, the soldier hung up. Pentagon officials tell CNN they're aware of the MP3 player, but can't talk about it until investigators confirm the information came from the Department of Defense.
The government is not doing a very good job protecting the information that it collects.
Despite government efforts to protect sensitive information, privacy experts say this is a growing technological problem. 2 years ago, the Department of Veterans Affairs lost track of a laptop with personal information of millions of soldiers, and computer hard drives with classified military information were found for sale at street markets in Afghanistan.
When you can identify American military personnel, when you have their name, their home addresses, their cell phone numbers, you actually put people in a very dangerous position.
Fortunately for the several hundred soldiers whose personal information is stored on this device, the secret data landed in friendly hands.
Chris Ogle tells it that he has put the MP3 player in a safe place and will happily turn it over to U.S. military officials if they ask for it. John and Kieran?
It's Midland Madera this morning, and I can imagine that he's going to get a call from somebody probably in the next few hours and say, pick that up for me, please.
What a wild situation. And that's the thing. I mean, you can put so much information on these tiny little devices.
Because not only do they hold music, but they act as hard drive as well. And, you know, we've got 20, 40 gigabytes in some of these. That's a lot of information.
It really is. All right, I think if that's squared away and straightened out, don't do that again.
Oh, they'll never do it again. The update, again, from the Associated Press. DOD gets their MP3 player back with their military data. U.S. officials took possession Wednesday of an MP3 player that a New Zealand man found held 60 U.S. military files, including names and phone numbers of American soldiers. Chris Ogle, 29, from the northern city of Whangarei, New Zealand, said he bought the music player in February or March last year for $18 at a thrift shop in Oklahoma City and found the files when he linked the device to his computer. I was very surprised. I was curious enough to keep looking, and I guess the more I looked, the more intense it seemed to me. Each time I looked at it, I became more convinced it was possibly something bigger. The private information in the files included troops' social security numbers and even which female troops were pregnant. Details of equipment deployed to bases in Afghanistan, including the main U.S. base of Bagram, and a mission briefing were also found in the files, most of them dated again from 2005. Some of the files included a warning that the release of the contents was prohibited by federal law. Ogle, who lived and worked in Oklahoma for 5 years until last month, said he had no idea about the origins of the device before seeing it in the store and that it didn't really ever work as an audio player with the sound cutting out before it even made it through an entire track. Two U.S. Embassy staff from the capital, Wellington, visited Ogle at his home Wednesday and took possession of the MP3 player, exchanging it for a new one. "That was cool. It was a pretty serious upgrade," Ogle said, laughing. U.S. Embassy officials did not immediately return calls for comment from the AP. Links and more on this silly yet disturbing story of military corruption. And in this case, just good old incompetence. BBC, Wikinews, as well as that full video from CNN, as well as military.com, and also the New Zealand Herald, The Age, and Danger Room. Sensitive Army files found on used MP3 player. Which brings us to the latest 9/11 updates. NSA, money trail, insider trading, and drills. This, I believe, is more at the heart of getting at the story, the real story, the hidden story of 9/11. We noted several months ago, James Bamford, noted author, investigator, historian on the National Security Agency, the NSA. His books, Puzzle Palace, A Pretext for War, and his newest one, I believe, The Shadow Factory. When that book came out, we noted that they were working with PBS and Nova to make a special. They have made that special, and I believe it's called The Spy Factory, where, as Raw Story fortunately points out, as again, believe there are folks at rawstory.com that are complete 9/11 truthers, and they put up good articles from time to time. Anytime they can put up some 9/11 news that's pertinent, that's actually pertinent, Raw Story, I gotta hand it to them, we'll cover it. NSA could have prevented the 9/11 hijackings. Again, this from Raw Story. The super secretive National Security Agency has been quietly monitoring, decrypting, and interpreting foreign communications for decades, starting long before it came under criticism as a result of recent revelations about the Bush administration's warrantless wiretapping program. Now, a forthcoming PBS documentary asks whether the NSA could have prevented 9/11 if it had been more willing to share its data with other agencies.
Halfway between Baltimore and Washington, D.C., is a hidden city. The headquarters of the National Security Agency, NSA. Here, tens of thousands of mathematicians, computer scientists, analysts, linguists, and voice interceptors work in absolute secrecy.
For those in the know, the joke was always that NSA stood for no such agency. For those on the inside, the joke was that NSA stood for never say anything.
NSA's job, to secretly listen in on telephone conversations, email communications, anything and everything that might warn a plot to do harm.
The scope of what happens at NSA is mind-boggling. I don't think the average person can even begin to conceive of the staggering depth and breadth of what they have to do.
But was NSA doing its job before the 9/11 attacks? It's a question that has never been thoroughly investigated.
None of this information that we're speaking about this evening is in the 9/11 Commission report. They simply ignored all of it.
But author James Bamford has investigated and come up with a chilling tale of terrorists living in San Diego, communicating with Bin Laden's operations center in Yemen, moving freely about. And all the while, NSA is listening in.
But the NSA never alerted any other agency that the terrorists were in the United States and moving across the country towards Washington.
Since the 9/11 attacks, NSA's role has grown even bigger, along with its license to listen in on Americans here and abroad.
It was incredibly uncomfortable to be listening to private personal conversations of Americans. And it's almost like going through and finding somebody's diary.
But is this flood of information making America any safer? Looking in to the Spy Factory. On Nova, coming February 3rd to most PBS stations.
The Spy Factory from PBS, from Nova. Of course, notes that the NSA was listening to the hijackers, but they didn't share any of the data. Because these guys were black operatives that had cover from higher up. They were living with FBI informants. J. Michael Springman, consulate, visa office, Jeddah, saw these guys go through and said, hey, they're kind of flagged as terrorists. Yeah, let them through. They're part of an operation. So we'll be interested to see what PBS and Nova does with that, the Spy Factory. And again, we heard Bamford, we heard Adrian Kine, all these folks that came out a couple months ago when these interviews and things were first coming out with Bamford's new book and this PBS special. However, moving to Nafiz Ahmed and his blog, Terrorists Working for Western Countries. Again, Nafiz Ahmed writing, it came to my attention that a senior correspondent, Kristen Ahlen, A-A-L-E-N, working for a national Norwegian broadsheet, Stavanger Evening News, roughly translated, just recently printed a detailed article in the newspaper on Western covert operations sponsoring Al-Qaeda after the Cold War. And it is based almost entirely on Nafiz Ahmed's research in The War on Truth, 9/11, Disinformation, and the Anatomy of Terrorism. Which, of course, you can hit up on Amazon and probably download a PDF if you look hard enough. The article from Kristen Ahlen in the Stavanger Evening News is called Terrorists Working for Western Countries. And it was published back on November 24th. It gives even a nice handy-dandy 9-link to it, country-by-country summary breakdown, complete with handy geopolitical world map of the wide arc of these operations. It's a very useful piece from a mainstream national European paper that very effectively summarizes the thrust of Nafiz Ahmed's research into this unpalatable subject. A shame that the British press is so reticent about such issues. There are some caveats. Kristen sometimes oversimplifies my geopolitical explanations, and this can lead to serious misinterpretations, such as her rendition of my examination of Pentagon sponsorship of Al-Qaeda fighters in the Balkans. She says that the U.S. and NATO helped the Bosnian Muslims against the Serbs, provoking them and thus preventing peace. This is a caricature of my argument, which is more fully fleshed out in The London Bombings, an independent inquiry. Again, linked to Amazon. Again, in mainstream press all around the world, drugs are propping up banks. The terrorists are working for Western countries. Rogue trader. And first, you have to ask the question, was he really a rogue? And second, is he a traitor or a traitor? Rogue trader, Wall Street trader, like my friends in Alabama, the Wall Street traders. What's up? Rogue trader highlights possible 9/11 and 7/7 insider trading. This from Steve Watson. According to an article in the London Times, with a link for you, Societe Generale rogue trader Jerome Kerviel. That's Jerome, K-E-R-V-I-E-L. He worked for Societe Generale. Links to more about Jerome, more about Generale, and the London Times story. According to an article in the London Times, a rogue trader, Jerome Kerviel, profited enormously on the day of 7/7, the London bombings. He has also revealed how his company made huge profits on 9/11, prompting some to return questions over insider foreknowledge of both terrorist attacks. Jerome says, quote, "The best trading day in the history of Societe Generale was September 11, 2001. At least that's what one of my managers told me. It seems that profits were colossal that day. I had a similar experience during the London attacks in July 2005. Kerviel was charged almost exactly 1 year ago in the Societe Generale trading loss incident, which cost the financial services company an estimated 4.9 billion euros. Until the Bernie Madoff fraud incident last month, it was reported to be the largest fraud in banking history. Again, in the new financial world order, breaking records every week. Biggest bank heists ever. The last two articles on this 9/11 updates posting, NSA money trail, insider trading, and drills. It's about the drills. It's about the terror drills. From 9/11 blogger, yet another military exercise occurring on 9/11 uncovered. When it seems impossible to discover additional shady military exercises occurring on 9/11, there comes along yet another investigator uncovering secret documents pointing to unprecedented military actions happening the same day. National Security Archive Senior Fellow Jeffrey T. Richelson is reporting in his new book, with a link for you, Defusing Armageddon, Inside Nest, America's Secret Nuclear Bomb Squad. Richelson, in his book, Defusing Armageddon, he reports that the U.S. Nuclear Bomb Squad, known as the Nuclear Emergency Search Team, was out of the country on its first foreign deployment since 1998 at a British airbase in the Cotswolds on 9/11 as part of Operation Jackal Cave. J-A-C-K-A-L, Jackal Cave, C-A-V-E. According to the book, Defusing Armageddon, the exercise involved more than 500 personnel, 62 aircraft, 420 short tons of cargo, the CIA, and a special ops force that would seize a mock nuclear device that the Nest Squad would disable. The after-action report from the deployment, DOE Exercise 0301 Jackal Cave, link for you, notes the early termination of the exercise because of the attacks, but finds useful strengths and weaknesses, including the need to issue secure international cell phones to control members and team leaders. The heavily redacted report created in 03 and prepared for the Department of Energy's Office of Emergency Response by the Oak Ridge Institute for Science and Education gives only hints of the exercise, including continuing training and exercises between the Department of Energy's Joint Technical Operations Team, JTOT, and the Army's 21st Ordnance Company to enhance command and control relationships. A September 13, 2001 report by the BBC quotes British squadron leader John Morris of Royal Air Force Station Fairford that U.S. planes were flying to the station after being recalled from their participation in Operation Jackal Cave. British squadron leader John Morris is also quoted in a story printed in the Swindon Advertiser in Southwest England with a link for you. In an article dated August 30th, 2001, and in which he describes RAF Fairford, a former wartime base, hosting a major United States European Command sponsor training exercise between September 5th and the 18th, 2001. Morris said Fairford would be used as a transit point for the exercise. Yet another terror drill military war game going on 9/11 discovered, Operation Jackal Cave. Again, we've now discovered, thanks to the book Defusing Armageddon, and thanks to the folks at 911blogger.com. The second one from them, again, the drills, again, rehearsing 9/11. How how training exercises foretold the attacks. In the aftermath of 9/11, senior U.S. officials and military officials repeatedly claimed that what happened that day was unexpected. In May 2002, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice said, quote, "I don't think anybody could have predicted that these people would take an airplane and slam it into the World Trade Center, take another one and slam it into the Pentagon, that they would try to use an airplane as a missile. A hijacked airplane is a missile." With a link to thewhitehouse.gov for you. Source 1. 2 years later, President Bush stated, quote, "Nobody in our government, at least, and I don't think the prior government, could envision flying planes into buildings on such a massive scale." Link to WhiteHouse.gov. Source 2. General Ralph Eberhardt, the commander of NORAD, on September 11th said, quote, "Regrettably, the tragic events of 9/11 were never anticipated or exercised." Link to USA Today. Source 3. Yet, these claims, all three of those, are untrue. Not only had the U.S. military and other government agencies discussed the possibilities of such attacks, they also conducted numerous training exercises in the year or two before 9/11 based around scenarios remarkably similar to what occurred on 9/11. As John Arkilla, professor of defense analysis at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, said, quote, "No one knew specifically that 20 people would hijack four airliners and use them for suicide attacks against major buildings, but the idea of such an attack was well known and had been wargamed as a possibility in exercises before 9/11. Link to MontereyHerald.com, source number 4. The existence of these training exercises proves that official claims that the events of 9/11 were unimaginable have been false. However, future investigations of 9/11 will need to determine whether these exercises served a more nefarious purpose. For example, might they have been intended as a smokescreen for rogue individuals working within the military and other government, or I would say non-governmental, agencies who were involved in planning the attacks? Thus, if colleagues overheard these individuals discussing matters such as planes hitting the World Trade Center or crashing into the Pentagon, they could have claimed they were simply talking about a forthcoming training exercise. At the bottom of this 9/11 updates posting is a comment from my man Alex in Germany to an article on Global Research, of course, about history repeating itself. He notes that they had that there in Germany 75 years ago, when in a false flag event, the Reichstag was burned down, the Patsy was executed, the Enabling Act was passed, and the Third Reich was on. So in 9/11, we have a false flag event. The Patsy is named. The Patriot Act is passed. And the Fourth Reich begins. 9/11 updates, NSA, money trail, insider trading, and drills. Side note, James Corbett at CorbettReport.com, who does great work, great podcasts. Recent episode, The 9/11 Money Trail, again, is important because, as I try and do as well, not spend time on the controlled demolitions. Much like the Obama citizenship question. Let's look at the drills. Let's look at the connections. Let's look at the money trail. Two massive posts on the Police State International. First, FEMA camps, biofuels, cyborg killbots, and the Department of Homeland Stupidity. Now, as we heard in a clip much earlier about closing bases, closing the camps, closing those facilities, they're closing some of them abroad. However, they're opening them here. H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Act. New legislation authorizes FEMA camps in U.S. This from Paul Joseph Watson. A new bill introduced in Congress authorizes the Department of Homeland Security to set up a network of FEMA facilities to be used to house U.S. citizens in the event of a national emergency. The National Emergency Centers Act, or H.R. 645, with a link to govtrack.us, read it yourself, H.R. 645 mandates the establishment of, quote, national emergency centers to be located on military installations for the purpose of providing, quote, temporary housing, medical, and humanitarian assistance to individuals and families dislocated due to an emergency or major disaster. The legislation also states that the camps will be used to, quote, provide centralized locations to improve the coordination of preparedness, response, and recovery efforts of government, private, and not-for-profit entities and faith-based organizations. Faith-based organizations, of course, being the clergy response teams, the churches that have been infiltrated to tell their flocks to lie down, turn in their guns, go to the camps. Romans 13, government is of God. That's your faith-based organizations there for you. Continuing, ominously, the bill also states that the camps can be used to, quote, meet other appropriate needs as determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security, end quote, an open-ended mandate which many fear could mean the forced detention of American citizens in the event of widespread rioting after a national emergency or total economic collapse. Many credible forecasters have predicted riots and rebellions in America that will dwarf those already witnessed in countries like Iceland and Greece. With active duty military personnel already being stationed inside the U.S. under NORTHCOM, partly for the purpose of quote-unquote crowd control, fears that Americans could be incarcerated in detainment camps are all too real. Links to NORTHCOM denying that the troops here are used for crowd control back to October, and of course, more on the active duty military personnel, more on the appropriate needs determined by the Secretary of Homeland Security, of course, now Napolitano. There's an article linked up from Lee Rogers that goes into this, and of course, the link to August 2007, clergy response teams to quell unrest. And that's, of course, was discovered, was broken. FEMA cozying up with pastors at the big churches to tell their flocks, Romans 13 says that government is of God. Turn in your guns, go to the camps when we say so, when there's a national emergency or the phony economy collapses. The National Emergency Centers Act, H.R. 645. Boy, I'm so glad Congress is back in session and all the wonderful bills they're passing, like FEMA camps here. It's fantastic. They're doing a lot of great work. We're going to hit some of the other bills that have been bandied about. However, a couple contract notes. And again, whenever we talk about the drills and the war games and the military-industrial complex, one of the big players we always like to look at is SAIC, Science Applications International Corporation, of course, involved in the FEMA Homeland Security terror drills top-off here in Portland, Oregon. And, of course, they've had to recuse themselves from bidding for part in Top Off 5 because of their conflict of interest. As we've seen, the revolving door between the military and the government or the media, it happens continually, both sides of the aisle. Oh, I used to work for the Federal Reserve. Oh, I'm now Obama's Treasury Secretary. Oh, my wife has sweet contracts with Big Pharma. These guys are all, they're owned. They're owned. SAIC awarded $25 million biofuels contract by DARPA. So, and again, when you see SAIC and DARPA together, you want to pay attention. So I subscribe to SAIC's press release feed. SAIC announced it's been awarded a prime contract by the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, that's DARPA, to help create an affordable alternative to petroleum-derived jet fuel. JP8. And of course, links in there for you to read more about JP8, DARPA, and even check out SAIC on the New York Stock Exchange. So, basically, they're going to make fuel from agricultural and aquacultural feedstock materials. DARPA's biofuels program explores energy alternatives and fuel efficiency efforts in a bid to reduce the military's reliance on traditional fuel. The press release goes on, and there are lots of links I've provided you. You can read more about biofuels and how to turn algae into fuel, but the question you should ask yourself is, where do we get that stuff? Sorry, It's not for you. It's for the military-industrial complex. However, you'll be blamed. It's all our faults. And we'll all now have to sacrifice and grow up and put away our toys because, oh, it's our fault. It's all the people's fault. And now we're going to have to tighten our belts. But we're not the ones who suppress technologies. So fuck you and fuck your sacrifice. The other one from SAIC, they got an $85 million contract from the Library of Congress. So again, you have private military contractors now being involved in our own very history of this country, the Library of Congress. Perhaps I'm reading too much into it, but I don't like it. The last two notes, well, not really, but two notes on this Police State International heading, Killbots and Cyborgs, techradar.co.uk, or rather techradar.com, will 2009 become the year of the killbot? Robot maker iRobot announced its 2008 financial figures, but more interestingly predicted that sales of military robots would soar in 2009. The cybernetic manufacturer revealed that its government and industrial business grew more than 50% in the last quarter compared with the same period a year ago, taking in revenues close to $305 million. Domestic robots like the RoboCleaner Roomba 500, and the gutter-scouring Luge help international sales double year on year, and of course it gets the idea of having military robots run around and vacuum your carpet and clean out the gutters, acclimating you to it. So sometimes when they have guns or tasers on them, you go, oh yeah, that's a Roomba. He tased me. iRobot has already been awarded $2 million by Congress to develop the Warrior 700 linked to you to the UPI on that military-industrial complex contract. Warrior 700, a powerful and rugged robot for use in danger zones and inaccessible areas. The Warrior 700 will perform a variety of critical missions, including real-time video, audio, and sensor readings to combat troops and local law enforcement SWAT teams. Coming soon to a town near you who has been federalized and the military are taking over your police. The robot features an advanced digital architecture and a multi-mission chassis that supports yada yada bullshit. I'm not going on with this. Will 2009 become the year of the killbot? And if you want to just start to look at, what was it? Big Dog from Boston Dynamics at some of the amazing military robots that literally, you know, when you get two guys in a costume and the one guy in the back is the legs and the horse's ass and the other guy in the front is the front legs, it literally looks like two guys in a costume, but they're, say, connected at the head. This robot walks around, can move around, won't lose its footing on ice. Someone comes along and gives it a huge kick, and it's able to adjust itself and never fall down. It's supremely disturbing. So staying on this note of DARPA, mad science, military killbots, the Pentagon's cyborg beetle spies take off. Again, of course, from Danger Room. Perhaps you are not particularly worried about the idea of remote-controlled insects spying on you on behalf of the Pentagon. DARPA-funded researchers at the University of California in Berkeley would like to disabuse you of that notion. They've succeeded in controlling a live rhinoceros beetle by radio. Researchers hooked a series of six electrodes up to the brain and muscles of the insect. Then, during a demonstration at the MEMS 2009 academic conference in Sorrento, Italy, quote, they equipped the beetle with a module incorporating a circuit to send signals to the electrodes, wireless circuit, and microcontroller and battery. The university has so far succeeded in several experiments of electrically controlling insects, but it used a radio control system this time. It's one of a number of DARPA-backed experiments to develop insect spies. The University of Michigan has its own cyborg beetles with a link for you. University of Georgia researchers are implanting mini machines into larval moths with a link for you, so of course they can live to a ripe old remote-controlled age. And then there's the idea to use sex-starved insects to follow bank robbers. Seriously. The flashback, going to June 2007 on MediaMonarchy.com, DARPA to create brain-chipped cyborg moths. And now we see, less than 2 years later, they've done it. There was a story, and now I'm just trying to pull it off the top of my head, from several months ago, where they had this sort of dragonfly spy bug robot. And, of course, they were deploying them at demonstrations where they could fly around and get in your face and take a picture, and they scan it, and it's biometrics, and it goes in a database, and you're now an enemy of the state. Now, the last bit on this police state posting: FEMA camps, biofuels, cyborg killbots. It's time for a little homeland stupidity. This from thinkprogress.org. DHS has published a 315-page book honoring Michael Chertoff's select speeches. There is a photo. The book does look really nice. The Department of Homeland Security recently sent out an entire book honoring former Secretary Michael, son of the devil, which is what Chertoff roughly translates to in Russian, Michael Chertoff's select speeches from 2005 through 2008. The 315-page book contains 36 of Chertoff's speeches and press conferences, many of which, if not all, are most likely available online. Link, 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 link. Think Progress recently obtained a copy of the book and contacted Homeland Stupidity to find out how much taxpayer money was spent on the book's production. However, we received no response. But Michelle Nix, former top official for former DHS Secretary Tom Ridge, who of course later came out and said that, yes, we politically timed the terror ratings, orange, yellow, green, blue, red. Michelle Nix told Think Progress that this homage seemed to be exclusive to Chertoff, as the department did nothing similar for her former boss, Tom Ridge. Let us know in the comments section on thinkprogress.org if you remember any of Chertoff's speeches being particularly memorable. I remember him saying he had a gut feeling about terror attacks right at some opportune moment. However, the second police state international posting: borders, biometrics, and Super Bowl security. Yes, my friends, it's time for the Super Bowl yet again, where millions and millions of people line up to watch the bread and circus facsimile bullshit of actual struggle, and it gets out your little primal rage, and you think you're really part of something, and you're not. Police state international: borders, biometrics, and Super Bowl security. First, from the AP, U.S.-Mexico border fence almost complete. Woohoo! It's really going to keep us in and not keep anyone else out. Not like you need a fence to always do that anyway. You would just have to, I don't know, enforce some laws that are already on the books. But now let's build a fucking fence. U.S.-Mexico border fence almost complete. From the AP, the fence along the U.S.-Mexico border is mostly finished. Customs and Border Protection spokesman Lloyd Easterling says that 601 miles of the project had been completed as of a week ago. Easterling says 69 miles of the fence still must be built to meet the goals set during the Bush administration. In December, then-President-elect Barack Obama said he wanted to evaluate border security operations before he considers whether to finish building the fence under his administration. Easterling said that the Obama White House has not told Homeland Security to stop. Does that mean tacit approval? We don't know. Links in there to read more about the United States-Mexico barrier, and newsroomamerica.com for more on the U.S.-Mexico border fence almost complete, as they work on a new monetary system that will probably almost be complete. So again, we had the mainstream article from MarketWatch talking about a new currency, a new North American currency. Again, problem, reaction, solution. They create the crisis, whether it's 9/11, terror, or some sort of scare, or whether they're crashing the economy on purpose from fake money and derivatives and hedge funds and banks and usury and money lenders. They're going to crash it. You're going to call for something. Oh, something's got to be done. Give us some new solution. Give us some new money to believe in. Amero, North American currency. They're talking about it. Wall Street Journal, International Herald Tribune, Market Watch. It's all around. But I digress. Again, from the Associated Press, military still pushing the biometrics agenda That's not the original headline, but this one works better. On the front lines in Iraq, U.S. troops can scan someone's eye or finger to try to determine if he is a potential enemy or has been connected to a terror attack. At military bases on U.S. soil, it's not that easy. The use of biometrics, ranging from simple fingerprints to more advanced retinal and facial scans, has thrived in Iraq, where soldiers carry handheld devices that enable them to link to databases filled with hundreds of thousands of identities. But in Colorado, military bases just 20 miles or so apart have different ID requirements and access procedures for personnel or contractors trying to get onto the property. The gaps raise security concerns and worries of another attempted massacre scheme like the one foiled at Fort Dix in New Jersey 2007. Phony bullshit terror plot with provocateur patsies who couldn't do shit but were got on tape after they were paid money to say, yeah, jihad, oh, we got them. Fort Dix threw half of it out. Phony terror cases. Liquid bombing plot, fake. No tickets, no passports, no bombs. Bullshit. Interestingly, we're probably further forward in using biometrics outside our country in some of the combat environments than we are inside the country. Of course, said Air Force General Jean Renart, R-E-N-U-A-R-T, head of NORTHCOM. We covered him many months ago, of course, when we signed agreements with Canada, of course, giving the ability for troops to move back and forth in the North American community. We've got to fix that, Renart said. Speaking at a biometrics conference, Renart said the military services and law enforcement agencies around the country all carry different ID badges, and many are embedded with different information. And in some cases, those agencies, he said, also have different computer databases that don't communicate well. So basically, we need a control grid for these biometric databases. PRWeb.com has more on the 2009 NDIA Biometrics Conference. However, fortunately, from Danger Room, again, they point out a little more of what Air Force General Victor Renart, Pentagon's Homeland Security Commander, head of Northern Command, NORTHCOM, of course, overseeing the combat brigades here in America. General wants to scan more U.S. irises and fingerprints. Air Force General Victor Renart, Pentagon's Homeland Security Commander, thinks one of the tools the military uses to combat insurgents in Iraq, the collection of biometric data, is needed here at home. The Associated Press had that, what we just read from, an alarming or intriguing quote from Renart, who spoke Tuesday at the Defense Industry Conference in Northern Virginia, of course, Spooksville, USA. I should know, I used to live near there, in West Virginia, in the Eastern Panhandle, which is right next to Northern Virginia. And unfortunately, one of the biggest biometrics companies in the world is based in my home state of West Virginia. Again, some of this will be a repeat, but we'll get there. Interestingly, we are probably further forward in using biometrics outside our country in some of the combat environments than we are inside our country. We've got to find a way to fix that. Tuesday's conference was devoted to discussion of the implementation of HSPD-24, Homeland Security Presidential Directive 24. The directive is supposed to harmonize the way federal agencies and the military collect, store, analyze, and share biometric data. As it stands, the Attorney General... Or rather, as it stands, the directive instructs the Attorney General, of course now going to be Eric Holder, to work with the Secretaries of State, Defense, Homeland Security, Director of National Intelligence, and the Director of Office and Science and Technology to create an action plan for implementing HSPD 24 by this June. The new administration may be reviewing a number of Bush directives, but now might not, or rather would, be a really good time to read up on the military's use of biometric technology. Now would be a good time, or 6 months ago before you voted. No reported extensively on the use of biometrics to deny freedom of movement to insurgents in Anbar province, that of course being Noah Shachtman of Danger Room. He also noted, link, 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 privacy and human rights implications. So, for good measure, go read fascinating transcript with a link of a blogger's roundtable from 2007 with a Lieutenant Colonel John Veliket, then the chief of biometrics collection in Iraq. In the conference, Renard seemed to be talking largely about security badges for military bases. But as anyone who's been on the receiving end of the U.S. military's biometrics identification process knows, it's an intrusive process. More importantly, deciding who has access to the databases and how that info will be shared will continue to be a major concern for the government and for privacy advocates. How can we get this technology of biometrics and facial scanning, minority report, iris scanning that we use abroad in our database, which of course is one of the rough translations for Al-Qaeda, how can we take that we use in military escapades abroad and bring it to military bases here? And not only that, how can we have those military bases that are now involved in infiltrating all your local law enforcement agencies, how can they all share that biometric data? We'll have it out by June. Again, from the Associated Press, again, privacy advocates, beware. The Supreme Court, SCOTUS, says passengers can be frisked. Supreme Court ruled last Monday that police officers have leeway to frisk a passenger in a stopped car for a traffic violation, even if nothing indicates the passenger has committed a crime or is about to do so. So, post or pre-crime. The court on Monday unanimously overruled an Arizona appeals court that threw out evidence found during such an encounter. The case involved a 2002 pat-down search of an Eloy, Arizona man, that's E-L-O-Y. A pat-down search in Eloy. What are the Eloy? That's right, the Eloy are the elite, stupid, blonde people that live above ground in the time machine, while the Morlocks toil below, occasionally emerging to grab one and eat one. Sorry. The case involved a 2002 pat-down search of an Eloy, Arizona man by an Oro Valley police officer who found a gun and weed. The justices accepted Arizona's argument that traffic stops are inherently dangerous for police and that pat-downs are permissible when an officer has a reasonable suspicion that the passenger may be armed and dangerous. The pat-down is allowed if the police, quote, harbor reasonable suspicion that a person subjected to the frisk is armed and therefore dangerous to the safety of the public and the police. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, link, you can read more about the case, Arizona v. Johnson, 07-1122. Supreme Court says passengers in the car can be frisked. Of course they can. Now we get, as we wrap it up here, we get to the two big upcoming events. Terror drills and the Super Bowl. So first, the Super Bowl. Behavior detection experts to boost Super Bowl security. This from the Tampa Tribune. If an officer asks you if you need help on Super Bowl Sunday, he might be more than just gracious. For the first time that we're telling you, the Transportation Security Administration's behavior detection officers are enhancing security at the championship event by watching people for combinations of suspicious behavior. Quote, they're trained to do exactly that, pick people out of a crowd, said Gary Milano, Federal Security Director for the TSA's Tampa office. These behavior detection officers don't have the power to arrest, but are uniformed behavioral experts. The TSA and the U.S. Secret Service trained about 70 Tampa police officers and Hillsborough County Sheriff's deputies working the event in their techniques. Milano, again a federal security director for the TSA in Tampa, says telltale signs of people about to engage in wrongdoing. That's what they look for. And you know where they learn this from? Well, let me stop mangling the sentence and back up a little bit. The telltale signs. Milano described them as, quote, telltale signs of people about to engage in wrongdoing, end quote, based on the Israeli security system. Each behavior, such as profuse sweating, could be innocent on its own, but raises eyebrows when coupled with other behaviors, Milano said. He declined to elaborate. behavior detection experts to boost Super Bowl security. I could really launch into a big long rant about bread and circus jocks and sports and my deep-seated hatred of all of it, but that would kind of be going back into a little too much teenager high school shit. Fuck you, jocks! But as we noted something before, that basically Homeland Security and TSA thugs and the people who submit to it at the Super Bowl totally fucking deserve each other. Lastly, the other upcoming event is, of course, terror drills in a city designed to acclimate people to the military taking over your town. This time, it's New Orleans. Terror drills from January 27th to February 8th. This from KATC.com. The New Orleans Police Department is warning residents not to panic if they see helicopters flying around the city after dark. The department will be hosting military training in and around the city between January 27th and February 8th. The training includes the use of military helicopters flying after dark throughout the city. Police say they want residents of New Orleans and outlying areas to know it's a training event. The activities, authorities say, have been carefully planned and are safe. The bitter ironies of terror drills and war games and police state activity in New Orleans is almost too much to kind of bear, as if that place hasn't been desecrated enough. You've got a whole desensitized mass of people who go, hey, it's Blackhawks. So the flashbacks, of course, it was now it's New Orleans. Flashbacks for you, black helicopters over Denver for terror drills. That was back in June, of course, as they were terror drill wargaming for the DNC. And then, of course, it came much closer to home in August, black helicopters over Portland for DOD terror drills. So we watch the drills, we watch the money trails, we watch the war games. It telegraphs their moves as we basically try and put this puzzle together. A couple quick words on the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. Not a big long list. It's also possible I didn't check it as much as I normally do. But it's a few, and they're interesting, as always. Like the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration out of Tallahassee, they Googled Financial Tsunami Stanley Monteith YouTube. The AFL-CIO American Postal Workers Union in Washington, D.C. Googled Royal Mail plus Sorting Machine plus Safety. Marshall University in Huntington, West Virginia, they were reading the warning from 2 summers ago, I believe. Cheney determined to strike in U.S. Of course, a play on the Bin Laden determined to strike in the U.S. University of Nevada in Las Vegas Googled war information found on MP3 player, and of course we went all over that. Our good friends at the Drug Enforcement Agency out of Arlington visited. Wyeth Arist Research out of Newark, New Jersey. The White Rabbit News.blogspot.com apparently has a link to MediaMonarchy.com, so I thank the White Rabbit News. And finally, the University of Hawaii Community College System in Honolulu, Hawaii Googled FEMA exercise, March 6th, 2009. Could that be the FEMA Northrop Grumman terror drill coming soon? I believe it is. So whether it's black helicopters over Denver, over Portland, over New Orleans, they're training to take over the cities. I can go on and on and on, probably, ranting about the Super Bowl, ranting about the criminal cabinet, and hoping that you've had your oh shit moment yet on the Obama administration. Of course, we're going to go more into the Obama deception when the documentary comes out on March 15th. And again, all you have to do is look at who's in the cabinet. Former Israeli Defense Force soldiers, or is the chief of staff for Obama. He's keeping Robert Gates, commander of the military right now, the front man for the military-industrial complex. If this whole phony change candidate was all about punishing the Bush administration and ending the war, don't you think he would get rid of the Secretary of Defense? Even just for, the face of it, since this is all about changing the face, and hopefully it'll change the psyche in the country. Oh, good, they got rid of Bush. It was all Bush. It was all Bush's fault, and now we're going to spread happiness. Yes, we can. My friends, that's going to do it for episode 109 of January 30th, 2009 of MediaMonarchy.com. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster, coming to you, as always, from the Portland Radio Authority, the Revere Radio Network, and KBFR 93.9 in Boulder. And, of course, FaceSpace, YouTube, Yahoo, IM, Skype, iTunes, RadioForAll.net, and Archive.org. Please spread the word about the show. Please spread the word. Tell somebody. Hey, check out MediaMonarchy.com. He's saying all this crazy stuff about Obama. But it's the right questions. And remember, if they can get you to ask the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about what the answers are. But like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get in just the same.
Are you ready for a world of challenge, of possibilities, of ambiguity and adventure? Be a part of the National Clandestine Service at the Central Intelligence Agency. Are you a person of purpose, professionalism, with a strong sense of patriotism? Make a world of difference as a CIA officer with the National Clandestine Service. Learn more at CIA.gov. The work of a nation, the center of intelligence. Equal opportunity employer. U.S. citizenship required.